Okay, let's get at the news on the record. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. When you renew your car tabs in Washington State, you will send $5 to the State Parks Department unless you actively say you don't want to do that. It's called opt-out. Some people like it. Some people resent it. Either way, the person who's most responsible for opt-out just won the Nobel Prize in Economics this morning. Richard Thaler pioneered the idea that there are some decisions government should help you make because you're not rational or you're not disciplined enough to make that decision yourself. But it's something that you actually want. Here to tell you what's wrong with that Nobel-winning theory and with your automatic car tab donation is Paul Guppy, our friend from the Free Market Washington Policy Center. Hiya, Paul.
Hi. Paul, thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. You are not celebrating this morning's Nobel Prize. What is wrong with the Washington Parks Department nudging you to contribute five measly bucks?
Well, we don't entirely disagree with Professor Thaler's nudge theory.
Okay.
There are parts of it that are good. In fact, I'll give an example right now, is that the match that KUOW is offering for your pledge drive,
mm-hmm.
that is a nudge, and that's very positive.
Oh, yeah, that's
right.
People
see that if they make a choice, they get an added benefit from that. So I think that's being used in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to government artificially increasing your car tabs by $5 and then giving you an option to get your $5 back, it's that opt out rather than opt in that's which begins to be a bit manipulative, and that's where ethical questions are raised about, again, government agencies doing this. But I would say the same thing about, you know, the phone company or anybody who collected more money than you owed and then offer you a way to get it back. So I think that's taking the idea too far.
This was a law change in Washington State. It happened 8 years ago. Before then, if you wanted to donate to the Parks Department, you had to opt in. You had to actively choose yes.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul, the opt-in rate was less than 2%. Now with opt-out, about half of us give $5 to the Parks Department. Does that tell you that we don't mind the donation? You could take it off if you wanted to.
Sure. So I would question whether we're actually giving the money voluntarily, because the government has already collected the money and given you a sort of difficult way to get it back, or at least you have to take an active step, check a box to get the money back. And by the way,
it's two bubbles. The yes one is checked, and you just check the one below it that's a no. It's not difficult, right?
Sure, but the statement, the summary includes the $5. I mean, you know, you'd have to go through this process. But I guess my point is that the first step that the legislature should do is fund the parks and not create a kind of a dodge, which is to say that they're depending on the $5 checkoff up to a certain level to fund the parks. I think that's just shorting an essential public service. So they should fund the parks with what they're needed. And then if people want to give additionally, they should make that possible.
Well,
but it looks like the legislature is depending on the $5 opt-out up to a certain level, and I just think that's a weakness in how they budgeted funding for the parks.
Well, the argument 8 years ago was if you don't want your money going to the parks and your legislature sent it there, you had no choice. Now all you have to do if you don't want the money to go is check that no bubble.
So, again, I don't think that's a good public policy mechanism for funding an essential government service. I mean, we elect people to collect tax money and fund the government. And so to get it down to this level where you have a menu of options as to where you want your money to go, I don't think that's a practical way to fund public services. I think it is good for people to donate additional money to services that they want to support, like the parks. But I don't, as a budget mechanism, I don't think this is the right philosophy that the legislature should be using. I mean, fund the parks up to what is needed, and then go to the public if they want to voluntarily give more. I think that's the approach they should take.
Do you pay the $5 yourself?
I don't. Okay. And for the reason that I just explained, which is I don't want to let them off the hook for providing the full budgeting that the parks need. Instead of going, that's why I see it as a bit of a dodge that they put me in this situation where I have to check, you know, $5 in, $5 out. It's just an approach that I don't think is the right way to fund essential services.
Okay. You're proving it's not crazy hard to do, but I understand all the philosophical reasons for your objection.
Yeah, I don't like being nudged in this way.
Yes. Only in a pledge drive kind of way.
Because that's voluntary, and you know, it's the nudge that KUOW is doing, and I just mentioned that to kind of support you guys, worth it.
That's but not why I called you, by the way. That was just a nice favor.
But as an illustration, that's exactly right. So a person could give money to KUOW, which is a good thing in itself, but then in addition to that, if you can double your donation because someone else is going to match it, even better. So that is exactly the kind of positive incentive that I think, and Professor Thaler writes about this. He says specifically, nudges are meant to minimize conflict without manipulating or fooling people. So it is a gentle way of offering options that are positive while avoiding, you know, mandates or punishment. And again, this would be more like the public sector, where instead of the government, you know, imposing a fine on somebody, they find a way to encourage people to make positive choices.
Paul Guppy from the Free Market Washington Policy Center talking about this morning's Nobel Prize to economist Richard Thaler, whose work showed us how irrationally we make many of our financial decisions. One result of his work is the opt-out system that sends $5 of your dollars to the park system unless you say otherwise. And for winning the Nobel, Thaler will receive a prize of about $1 million, some of which he will no doubt waste on some irrational expenditures. Paul, it's always good to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thanks for having me.
KUOW is the record on listener-supported KUOW Seattle. Okay, on KUOW's The Record, here is another example of a topic we cover on this radio station that's not easy, but it can be good for you. I'm talking about the end of life, also known as death. It can be scary, hard to imagine, something you don't want to think about. It's emotional when it happens to a loved one. But our next guest says you'd be better off if you get comfortable with death. Caitlin Doty is a mortician and the author of the new book, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. She and Jeff Jorgensen, the founder of Elemental Cremation and Burial in Seattle, they want people to talk more about how they want to die and be buried. Caitlin says you need to be more intimate with death. Get in there, dig the hole, cry, hug the body.
That's a great introduction to me. Dig the hole, cry, hug the dead body. Wow. That sounds like exactly what I stand for in my advocacy. Yeah, I think that 100, 150 years ago, that's what everybody did with their dead. When we talk about the American way of death, that's what we're talking about. That's what we did for hundreds of years. And then in the early 20th century, you have this for-profit funeral industry that arises that says, oh, no, 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 you're not qualified to take care of the dead body. You give it to us and you pay us, and now we'll do all of this. And I think now people are starting to wake up, especially in the Seattle area, to this idea that we can reclaim this. We can once again be a part of this. And they feel like something's missing. They feel like when mom died, it had to be an emergency and she was just swept away behind the scenes immediately, ne'er to be seen again. And people are saying, no, I wanted to be there when she died. I wanted to sit with her body. I wanted to somehow be involved in the cremation or burial. And why wasn't I given access to that?
But funeral director Jeff, you offer what some people call alternative green burials. But what are the laws? Can I not involve any company or chemicals? I mean, can I bury someone in my yard in Seattle? What do I have to do?
There's a lot to that question. I'm happy to answer all of it. You have 24 hours in Washington State before you have to do something with that body, either embalm or refrigerate. And so it's up to you in that 24 hours. So take your time and think about it. Now, as far as burying in your backyard, that's an expensive and unlikely proposition.
Why expensive?
Well, you basically need to have your house set up as a cemetery, and it takes an endowment fund with the state of $25,000.
So wow.
Yeah, I mean, it gets complicated very fast.
Okay, that's some legal stuff. Caitlin, I want to get back to this idea of how we would feel about hanging out with mom after she's died, or mom's body, because that's not most people I know. I've been involved in some deaths, and you know, we are at a remove from our loved one at that time, and it kind of, I don't know, there's something comforting about it, and it sounds complicated, and someone else is taking care of it, and you're upset anyway. What could change in all that realistically in Seattle?
Well, first of all, it's important to know that it's completely safe to be around the dead body, and it's completely legal to be around the dead body. As Jeff said, you have that 24 hours to make any decision you want. And even if you don't want to make a decision, you can just put some dry ice or gel under the body and keep thinking about it. So you shouldn't be financially or stress pressured in any way to move forward until you're ready. As far as being with the dead body, if I just walked you into a room and there was a corpse or a dead body there of someone you didn't know, and I shut the door and said, good luck, you would say, what horror is this? What's going on? Why am I in this room with a dead body? But if it's your mother, or if it's your partner, or if it's your child, it's a completely different experience. This is someone that you've known your whole life and is a part of your life intimately. And now they're not there anymore. And sitting with them allows not only for you to start to accept that this person really is not here anymore and your life is forever changed, but it also allows you to reflect on the fact that someday you too will die. And someday you will be as this person is, dead. And that's an incredibly valuable experience that not everyone is prepared to take on. And obviously, there's a whole funeral industry waiting for you if you don't want to take that on. But for the people who hear that and say, wait a minute, that appeals to me, they should just know that it's available to them.
Jeff, as someone who is so familiar with death, I'm sorry to hear that you recently, 4 years ago, lost your mother. So when it actually, when that became real for you and was impending, what was it like personally? As separate from the your theories.
Outside my licensure and outside, you know, death is, you know, people ask, you know, are you less afraid of death than, you know, before you started this? And the answer is no, death is terrifying. It is terrifying for everyone on some level. When you're around it, it gets a little easier because you know what happens after the fact. When my mom was ill and, you know, it was a fairly short 6-month battle with cancer, you know, there's a lot of emotion in that. And when the time actually comes, you know, the day of her death, I hadn't really had that conversation with her. And I said, Mom, do you want to be cremated? And she said, well, yeah, isn't that kind of the option? And it was a 15-second conversation that I had, and I no longer have questions. And so that's the kind of dialogue that we should be having long before. And here I am, a professional, and I dropped the ball.
Well, what was so bad about not having a conversation before those 15 seconds?
The cost of only having that 15-second conversation and only having that dialogue at a late hour meant that I didn't get to have that discussion of what options were available to her, or we didn't have a dialogue about what might bring her healing knowing about it beforehand, or what might bring me healing after her passing. There wasn't the fidelity of conversation that would allow for that larger healing. When she died, it was very surreal because I actually succumbed to that, oh my gosh, we've got to do something right now. You know, I watched her take her last breath, and after about 5 minutes, I said, all right, I've got to get her dressed, and filed her permits and met her at the crematory a couple days later, and then I witnessed the placement into the chamber. And I cremated her.
And she died in a hospital and not at home?
Correct.
Was that always the plan?
No, we had hoped to have her at home, but there was some pain management and some, I mean, you get into the healthcare thing and they can't do injections at home and blah, 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 all the details there.
And how did that experience change anything, if it did, in the way you view death and how the rest of us view death?
The experience was interesting because I think the hospital death, when we talk about a good death and when Caitlin and I talk about, you know, crafting this death for people as funeral professionals, you know, we want that death in the home. We want you to take care of your loved one. We want you to do all of these things. And the reality is the medical system kind of is geared to keeping people in hospitals. And so I was very fortunate because I'm a funeral director and I'm outspoken and rather pushy. They gave me that space at the hospital. But it's a very difficult thing for a family. You have to be very forward in what you want to do.
Caitlin, Jeff said in telling that story that death is terrifying to everyone. You don't seem terrified. Does death terrify you still?
I don't trust people when they say, I don't know if you've ever met this type of person. Usually it's a man who says, you know what? I've always been completely fine with death. I don't worry about it. Just do whatever with me. What you're doing is cute, but it doesn't really matter. I don't trust them farther than I can swing a cat, because I think that people who have really seen death, whether they've worked in the death industry, whether they've had watched someone die, whether they've been present when people die, when you see the reality of death, there's such a profound respect that you have for death, and you're not flippant about it, and you understand the great force on humanity that it is. And so I'm not terrified of death, but part of me will always be in conversation with it and worried about it and when it's coming and when it's coming for the people that I love. And the conversations that I have with death are just to improve that experience when the time comes.
How does that improve your life?
It improves my life because I feel very self-aware. I think I'm someone who believes that the Grim Reaper has his hand up all our butts, that he's really controlling everything that we do, that that's so much about why we want to achieve and why we want to have children and have our names on buildings and build companies and host radio shows, is because we know we have a finite amount of time and we know that we have to do the most with what we have. And that's what death provides us, those deadlines, emphasis on dead. And if we don't have that, we'd be lost. We'd be walking around in this world of never-ending nothingness. And the fact that we have that in death is a blessing. And I feel really self-aware to understand that every day of my life.
Okay, so there, as you say, we're motivated by those deadlines. Can't we also be in denial in the meantime? Like, we don't have to think about death as much as you want us to.
Well, we're all in denial. We don't have a problem with a denial.
Uh-huh.
Like, we don't have a problem with denial. We have a problem with lack of denial. We have a problem with being open and having these conversations.
Well, what's like, so bad about denial? What do we lose if we just don't think about it until we have to?
Well, if, for example, with Jeff's story with his mother, and he did so much right with her, and just knowing about their relationship and how he was there at the end of her life, it's a beautiful story. And in so I don't want to take anything away from their final 15-second conversation about cremation, but he's exactly right then when her response was, yeah, I'm going to be cremated. I mean, what are the other options? What are the other options? That's exactly it. Like, is there something that they could have had a long conversation about where she wanted to be scattered? Or maybe she wanted to be buried. Maybe she wanted to break with family tradition. Or maybe she wanted to be taken somewhere after she died. You know, there are
any
number of
things. But what if she didn't want to talk about it? What if she, you know, are you sure? Maybe she just didn't want to have to think about it till 15 seconds. The shorter, the better. What do you think?
You bring up a good point, but I think I use that to illustrate this is a hard conversation, no matter how short, no matter how long. It is a hard conversation, but darn it, do it.
Do it also because people do not understand until someone that they are very close to dies how many decisions have to be made after death and how much paperwork there is, how much there is wills, how much there is advance directives, how much there is disposition of property. It's a complicated, complicated thing. And if you die without ever having that conversation or sharing what you want or getting your paperwork in order, you're leaving a massive burden on your family. And there's no way around that. And I know that you're afraid of death, and I know that you don't want to have that conversation, but if you don't want to make it so hard for your family beyond the grief they're already suffering in the fact that you're dead, you need to have that conversation.
And, you know, it isn't a singular conversation. If you try and tackle all of this in one conversation at the Thanksgiving table, oh boy, this is really a series of dialogues where you talk about the history of your family and the heirlooms you have around your house and the house you're sitting in and the estate and what bank accounts do you have? Because we just heard this thing on the radio about how most people don't even know how many bank accounts mom has. You know, that's the kind of stuff we see every day. Why are we trying to figure this out when they're dead?
Can you leave us with one piece of advice, something we could do to move a step closer to a healthier, more peaceful relationship with death?
I'm like, do we have time for a 12-part list?
Right.
It's not going to be one conversation. I've been picking away at my parents for years, death by a thousand little cuts of me trying to have this conversation with them. And it's a slow process, but it's so worth starting because once you start it, all sorts of other things will open up. Because once you acknowledge that somebody might die, that anybody in the world might die, it opens up emotional conversations. It opens up conversations about the past. It opens up conversations about the potential futures. And it just leads to, I believe, a more intimate relationship with the people close to you in your life, because there's nothing that brings people closer together than having a hard conversation.
And it doesn't all have to be negative. It's also a discussion about what you want to do with your time left. When Mom got diagnosed with cancer, all right, Mom, are we going to Scotland? You've never been there. Why don't we do that? And all of a sudden you have all of these things unfold that it's like, wait a minute, you know what? There are beautiful things that we can do with the time we've got left. So it can be a positive, fun conversation too that tackles some of these things.
That's Jeff Jorgensen, founder of Elemental Cremation and Burial in Seattle, an alternative green funeral home, and Caitlin Doty, mortician and the author of the new book, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. So she went all around the world to find how different cultures deal with death, and she told me how Seattle is really a quite death positive. There are a lot of progressive funeral practitioners here. One unique burial method is an interview that you may have heard me do. It has to do with composting a body. And I interviewed someone named Katrina Spade about her work locally on that topic. And we can tweet out a link to that interview now, or you can search Katrina Spade at KUOW.org. Okay, cheery stuff. How to deal with it the right way instead of the avoiding way on listener-supported KUOW. Artificial intelligence may be the wave of the future, but that wave can wait when it comes to our children. Mattel has just canceled a voice-activated device for kids that was powered by Microsoft technology. Here to tell you why this idea has failed for now is GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. Hiya, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
It's good. We're talking about this device called Aristotle. And what did Aristotle do?
What didn't it do?
Okay.
It essentially replaced almost every function of a parent. We actually talked about this on the record after I came back from the Consumer Electronics Show this year. My favorite feature was the setting that required kids to say please get Aristotle to respond. It did all sorts of other things. It answered questions from kids at bedtime until they fell asleep. It monitored them. It reordered diapers. This thing was like the AI Swiss Army knife in a lot of different ways. In fact,
I typically keep Swiss Army knives away from my children, and yet in this case, you know, maybe it would
exactly. In fact, they promise so much that it's a little bit fishy, frankly. You look at this, and I start to think of the old software term vaporware, where companies come out and promise a bunch of things. But nonetheless, they were planning, Mattel was, to release this for $300 this summer. And there was a backlash on two different fronts, one privacy and the other a philosophical discussion about parenting.
Yes. So let's take privacy first. What's the concern?
The concern is that this device would have such intimate knowledge of what your kids were doing, their speech development patterns, the types of things they were asking. And the whole idea with this device was to track kids as they grew up. So it would adapt from toddler to preschooler to kindergartner to elementary school to potentially teenager, and essentially deliver different features based on the kid's age. And legislators and parenting groups really objected to this essentially invasion of privacy. And it's fascinating because we have the technology that is in some ways here racing out ahead of our willingness to accept it into our lives. It's just too much for some people.
And what's the worst case scenario, though? The privacy would be invaded how?
You can imagine Mattel using information about your kid's development to then target you advertising, for example. Or perhaps your kid says something to Aristotle that then makes the system think, oh, well, you know, it's time for the acne cream. You know, it just sort of can get a little bit creepy.
Okay. And the other concern you mentioned was a philosophy of parenting.
That's right. I mean, this thing was the magic wand for parents. I actually kind of liked the idea. I don't know what that says about me as a dad, but I like the idea first that it instilled some sense of manners, you know?
Yeah, we disagreed about this last time.
Yeah, we did.
See, to me, it makes please into the magic word. I had that as a kid too. I don't think please is a magic word. If I'm asking you, Todd, please, can I have some sliced peaches? I am recognizing that I'm not entitled to the peaches. I'm recognizing that you don't have to do this. You're another human being with your own agency, and you're going out of your way to do something for me. I think that's a great connection. I don't like the say please and stuff rains on you.
I get that now. You might have just changed my opinion, Bill. Oh. That was really well done.
Wow,
yes.
Thanks.
I think you're more confident than I am as a parent.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, have you seen Westworld?
No.
At all? You know,
no.
The show that I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. The HBO show.
Yeah, where it's basically
it's
like
on my
a
list.
World of very intelligent robots. I'm just not sure that I'm a better parent than you know, a future sort of robot me.
Right.
And I also feel like, you know, it's the world of consumer choice. So I would, my son's 10. I think he needs to be polled about this to decide, you know, like what would be better, dad or robot dad?
Right. I like the challenging the assumption that, oh, wait, no machine could possibly parent as well as a human. There's some skepticism from David. I'm not that great.
It's not just also about the quality of parenting, but also just about replacing the function of parenting. One of the things that this promised to do, for example, was automatically recognize when a baby woke up and then soothe the baby to sleep with a lullaby like white noise or a favorite song or a nightlight.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually somewhat practical, although disturbing at the same time, because what if the baby is waking up for a real issue?
But still,
where do you draw the line?
I'm 100% sure the robot would have been better than me at that.
At soothing?
Yeah.
Todd, you're here with GeekWire. Is this a significant setback for the idea of artificial intelligence in the home?
I don't think it is. I think you've seen technology race out ahead and then come back and then society catches up. Think of Google Glass, the augmented reality eyewear that Google had out. That really fell through and fell by the wayside, largely because of privacy concerns. Just this past week, Google came out with a new device, a camera called Clips, and they adjusted their approach in a way that you could tell was informed by their experience with Google Glass. Clips is a camera, and it looks like a camera. There is no doubt that it is on, it is recording you, whereas Glass was very stealthy. So I think that what happens is the tech industry learns from these things. They test them, and then they figure out how to adapt them, and they come out with things that are perhaps even more further down the realm of data collection, but they're doing it in a way that's at least transparent.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, Clips is a sort of a wearable camera, right? You don't
right.
have to have it in your hands.
Right. The idea, you can even set it on things. And yeah. It'll record you sort of as a third person intelligently.
Mattel was using Microsoft Cortana intelligence technology. So how's this going over in Redmond?
You know, they have so many different products that are coming out. It actually also did use some Alexa as well.
Oh.
And that's where this device started to feel like vaporware to me. It was like, oh, we got everything. We got Alexa. We got Cortana.
And they're different personalities, too.
Yes, exactly.
True.
And you could summon Aristotle by saying that word Aristotle and a different assistant would come up theoretically.
Mm.
This is not a major setback for Microsoft. Yeah. I think they've still got a lot of companies that are using this Cortana intelligent services behind the scenes. And certainly Amazon is just taking off with Alexa. And we've seen Alexa now in everything from not only Amazon's devices, but for example, a new light that GE just came out with. So I think this is just one more step along the road toward our robot future.
Todd Bishop, following your path through a robot future on GeekWire. Big week for you at GeekWire, annual GeekWire Summit going on.
That's right. Starting this evening through Wednesday at the Sheraton downtown Seattle, we'll have Satya Nadella, Jeff Wilkie, the Amazon consumer CEO, Tony Reed, the head of Alexa, and many others, including Kevin Johnson, the CEO of Starbucks. It's going to be a big week.
Tell us what you find out, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, from GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Always good to see you. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you, Bill.
You've got KUOW's The Record on this listener-supported radio station talking about raising your kid, sometimes with a machine, sometimes some data may be collected. Thanks for tuning into the conversation. We'll get back to you in just a moment.